Thursdays in the second hour of the program means history class here on Korea Now with Professor John DeMoya from the Seoul National University, who joins us for the latest in Made in Korea. Professor DeMoya, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thanks very much for having me.
Today, again, we're going to go into something very interesting. Really, I can't say it's modern Korean history again. I mean, last week we talked about the history of the Taegeuk-gi and how it digs back to the Gojong era, King Gojong era. And this, again, similar during the colonial era of Korea. And there's two different names for this particular building. There is the GGK, the Government General of Korea, Joseon Chongdokbu building, or they also, I believe, called it the Japanese Government General of Joseon, I think was what is the name of
sure,
the other?
Or Government General Building of Japan, I've seen also more generically, sure.
Right. So
but representing it as the Government of Korea, or obviously representing the Japanese side of colonialism.
Exactly. And so the naming of this kind of changed over time here, but what we do know is this very building was demolished back in 1995 to 1996 and really held a long and very controversial history.
Exactly.
To how did this building come to represent Japanese imperialism? What functions did the building later serve under an independent South Korea? And why was it eventually slated for destruction? And we'll talk about this, but starting things off here,
sure.
Professor DeMoya, let's get the basics here. When was the building built and tell us why?
Sure. The building is built over a 10-year period between 1916 and 1926. However one feels about it, Japan formally colonizes in 1910, wants to begin legitimating itself, wants to begin constructing the city in a particular way. And anyone who's interested in this larger process of consolidation, Todd Henry at California San Diego has a wonderful book called Assimilating Seoul, which is actually about the physical and material changes the Japanese implemented to force Koreans slowly to assimilate themselves to the Japanese rule.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I want to read that.
Sure. Okay. But to give you the idea, this building represents Japanese power, but it's also spatially, because if you know where it is, downtown today where Gwanghwamun would be,
right.
It's meant to sort of block, cut off the traditional geomantic relationship between the Gyeongbokgung Palace and the city. It's very deliberate. The book, again, if you're interested, if you're not, it's okay, goes into even the way the streets were moved a certain way so that the building could block the geomantic energy a certain way. It's definitely built between Gyeongbokgung and the mountains and the rest of the city in such a way as that it starkly places Japanese power very much visibly in your face by the time it's completed in 1926. And then from 26 to 45, it will be one of the most powerful symbols of Japan being kind of physically in your face, kind of like, we're here, we rule you, again, whether you like it or not.
We know what this symbolizes. Again,
sure.
Like you said, it's basically
it's
Japan.
It's even built inside. Mm-hmm. I mean, when it started in 16, part of it is actually obviously involves the destruction of other facilities inside of and around Gyeongbokgung. So it's not only building Japanese power, it's very conspicuously dismantling older Joseon history.
Yeah, and that's
deliberate.
You talk about the symbol that this building has, right? But if we were to maybe compare to other government buildings, what would this be equivalent to? Like, will it be like a city hall? Will it be like a presidential office?
You mean outside Korea, or you mean in like world examples?
Oh, just world examples. Like, what would a building like this be?
I would describe this as comparable in the U.S. to the U.S. Capitol building.
Oh, okay.
This is where the governing facilities will take place. This is where the legislating will take place, as far as I understand.
So it has much bigger, I mean, it is big in that it's symbol of it. Basically, we're cutting off everything. We've taken over your country. This is what it is. But all the legislative stuff also went in here.
At least my understanding, though on the Korean side, yes, of course, not the diet back in Japan, but in the colony, yes.
Yeah, so let's talk about then the governing functions of this very building here and why. Again, becomes even more controversial later on.
Okay. Particularly, are we going to talk into colonialism? Or?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. The usual way Japanese colonialism in Korea is described is three periods, 10 to 19, harsh military rule, 19 to about 31, some so-called cultural rule or soft rule, and then 31 onwards, total war. To translate that in these terms, the building is completed in 26. It's part of then the soft cultural rule into total war. This is where Japanese rule over the colony is going to be consolidated, promulgated. I imagine for most Koreans, you probably don't have any real interactions with it. But again, it's kind of the symbol of power where you're going to learn everything that you are supposed to be doing as a colonial subject. And again, sorry, if we can think spatially in terms of the city, because I even feel this today when I walk through, remember that Namsan, which today feels like the center center of the city was then essentially the southern extent of the city.
Right.
Everything that's Gangnam and south of the river was really not Seoul, so to speak, at that time. So that the GGK building is like downtown traditional Seoul. Myeongdong is like the Japanese capital center.
It is.
And to be honest with you, if you get the feeling of it, this is Japanese government and capitalism. The Japanese settler population, this is their area, really. This is kind of their conduit between that building and, I guess, what would now be Myeongdong. And I think Korean population is meant to feel that.
You know what's funny? It's interesting you mentioned Myeongdong because
I definitely feel when I go to Myeongdong, like, wait, this is where Japanese shoppers used to be. And still are. Exactly.
And so,
I see the little tourist hotels with all the signs in katakana and hiragana, I'm like, yep.
Because when I first went to Myeongdong, and I mean, I've been in Korea for now, you know, almost 15 years.
It's the place where you still hear lots of Japanese and also Mandarin and other things.
Yeah. And I learned even before I first visited Myeongdong that Myeongdong was sort of where all the Japanese during the imperial
time, the colonial
time, they hung out there, they were doing shopping there, they drank, they ate. And that's kind of what we would say is today's, I don't know, where's all the hip place people going, like Hongdae, Gangnam?
According to my former students and present students at Seongsu-do, I don't know anything about that, but I've been told that that's hipster central.
Yeah, that's hipster central now.
I, being an older guy,
I'm not. Yeah.
To me, it was Hongdae and Myeongdong when I first came here.
So it's Hongdae, right? And so when I first went to Myeongdong for the first time, and I saw a lot of Japanese tourists going, I was like, things have not changed except for the fact that we are now an independent country.
I was just going to say, there's a big difference between being ruled and being soliciting their capital.
And so that area there, and I mean, I've learned my share of Korea's history during the Japanese imperialism. That Myeongdong, like you said, was kind of shopping central for many of the Japanese.
Sure.
There was a lot of Japanese shops over there. Jongno was considered the heart of Seoul and everything and anything that
happened
there.
That's basically the original, the Seoul certainly that becomes the modern urban place. Right?
And which is not surprising that they placed this in Gwanghwamun, the heart of, even we call this now the heart, maybe the heart of Seoul right now, even still right now, the symbolism. And so the Japanese already knew this, put this here, and a lot of things happening. I wonder, again, this took over time to be built.
Yeah.
And it happened, you said, in 1926?
26 is the completion, 16 is the start. The original architect is a German who spent time in Japan, George de Lalande, and he dies or passes away somewhere in the process in between, taken over by a Japanese architect, Nomura Ichiro. Mm-hmm. I got the impression that de Lalande, at least having been to Japan, how much he knows about the symbolism in terms of colonialism is thinking that, I don't know. But he certainly is thinking neoclassical in terms of what he had seen in late Meiji and Taisho Japan. And then presumably he brings that, whatever's in his head, to the site that he starts.
So the construction of this building is happening post-1919. And we talked about the March 1st independence movement.
Right, exactly. It's before and then continuing through that. Exactly.
Right, exactly. And so there's more, I guess, awareness of protesting and peaceful protesting.
I'm sure.
An expression of opposition to the Japanese government and so forth. So I wonder how Koreans felt about this when they were constructing this in the heart of Korea, what it simply was.
Okay, two things to add to that really quickly. And one, I got to admit, this is speculation, so I'll try to mark that.
Mm-hmm.
The one is that with the takeover, and I apologize, I forget the exact year of the first architect's death, but with Nomura taking over, there was talk that some of the Japanese experts, as you move towards the 20s and the completion of the building, actually started to limit some of the destruction of the surrounding facilities. In other words, kind of tone down the scale a little bit. And presumably, in the context of post-1919. The other, which is more speculative, but it's also more fun because I've heard this, so is if you ever see, you've seen the pictures of the building, correct?
Right.
Okay, have you ever seen the pictures of what it looks like from above?
No, I haven't.
Okay. If you know what the character for, if you know Ilbon in Korean and you know the character for the sun, Il. If you fly above it and it's basically a rectangular building, so this is where it's speculative. Did the Japanese really design a building that was meant to mark the character itself in addition to blocking the geomancy? I've never heard that confirmed as deliberate, but it's a popular apocryphal myth that's out there, so it has a power. It still comes up all the time.
Look, I mean,
if you see the pictures, I got to admit, it's weirdly resonant.
You look at a lot of what Japan did
yeah.
to the Korean people. There was a lot of physical stuff being done, but there was a lot of psychological
The geomantic stuff is absolutely true. The street, again, Todd Henry talks about this a lot, the way the streets were moved, the orientation, everything was done exactly to sort of block Gyeongbokgung, which probably leads to where we'll be going in a bit, which is the story of why you eventually deal with this building in a particular way.
Yeah, and I would not be surprised if what you said about the aerial view of the building, I would say it probably
It was one of the first things Koreans taught me when I came in the 90s. I put it this way, as a historian, if I want to keep my credentials, I would just say it's an interesting story. I would need more detail. I would like to need an architect's plans with the writing. Wow, we can really, you know, I've never seen that level of detail.
Kind of speaking of buildings, government buildings, did any of your Korean colleagues, when you first came to Korea, tell you that the National Assembly turns into a robot at night?
I had not heard that. The other one I did hear, if we're on this for just a moment, I heard, and I also think this is probably purely apocryphal, that all the streets in the southern part of the city, particularly the wide boulevards in Gangnam, were not only built that way because, you know, post 1970s, 80s development, lots more open space, but also so that planes could land there if there ever needed to be circumstances of another war, which I think is totally not true.
I haven't heard that.
Yeah, exactly. No, but it was, you know, 1990s kind of rumors.
If you look at Korea's history, fortunately, come August 15, 1945, you know, Korea is able to finally liberate themselves from Japan's tight grip. This building having all sorts of terrible symbols, symbolism for the Koreans. What purpose did the building serve after the liberation?
Okay, this is what's interesting. The building, of course, will be important in the American occupation and the Miguljung. I don't know how much they actually used it for governing, but they certainly use it, as they reuse many other Japanese facilities, not being necessarily aware of the residences. But then when you get to the important date, which is not Haebang, but the actual independence marked August 15, 1948, famous pictures of Lee Seung-man, Duncan MacArthur comes to town, and they're right sitting in front of this building, which will continue to be used up until the Korean War as the major center of Korean governing. I believe it is discontinued. It's also damaged during the war. And again, from doing a little bit of extra reading, it is Park Chung-hee who will bring it back from 62 as, again, a major facility for Korean governing. So in an interesting way, and again, you could, there's probably not a single correct quote-unquote reading of this, it's Koreans appropriating and making it their own again. It's, if you want to read it more darkly, it's Koreans kind of choosing to ignore all the symbolism and just continuing on blindly. But the building will continue through the 1960s, 1970s to be a major part of South Korean government functioning.
Again, it's really interesting how It took so many years before it was finally destroyed. But before we get into the destruction, the demolition of this particular building, what's the difficult heritage?
Sure. This is where it gets really interesting. Difficult heritage means, and historians and particularly museum curators like to use this language, and a friend at Sogang, Lee Hung-young, writes about this a lot. How do you deal with your own country's history when it deviates from things that make you comfortable? The famous example, which we can talk about, of course, is how do Germans teach what happened in the 1930s and 1940s? Okay. In the Korean case, of course, it's often applied to exactly the legacy of the Japanese colonial period. And then, right, what do you do with this building? Other examples would be the Korean City Hall, not the newer one, but the older Japanese one. Why is it still here? Even, for example, even some of the older buildings, some of the old department stores and things that, I know another one. I think the Chosun Bank is still there, which is probably from the colonial period downtown. How do you frame these buildings, continue to use them as your own, but recognize that they're part of your heritage that we need to talk about, but it's uncomfortable. That's why it's dark or difficult heritage is the term usually used.
I can't say what's worse or what's less worse.
But the German case is the most famous example.
Well, I mean, but then with the German case, it's them. They weren't the victims, right?
Right.
In Korea,
right,
case, they were the victims, and the history, the dark history is of them being victims. And so I guess it's a little bit easier to talk about and say this is what some of the things that we went through in the past.
But as we'll see with this building, is it easy to continue using it when you know?
That's the thing, So that's the thing, right? And it's, we can talk about it, but do we use this building?
Right.
Especially because of the symbolism that it has. Okay, then let's say, how do museum personnel, like curators, treat this kind of material? Because we now hear how historians do it. I wonder if they cover it in a more positive note. How do they feel about the reusing of these buildings?
Sure. I'm not a curator, of course, but I would imagine from talking with a lot of them, what you do, of course, is you mark carefully and try to be very careful. And as you just said, distinguish between saying something like, this is what this used to be, here's how we are now using it, and trying to both pay attention and respect the history despite its darkness, but also indicate its modern usage. Let me, if I can just give an example.
Sure.
When I lived in Berlin, in the southwest part of Berlin, there are many of the buildings that are left over, and it's part of Berlin called Dahlem, that were left over and used by the Nazis. Many of those buildings will have long explanations in German that basically indicate this is now this certain social, this is really close to the Freie University of Berlin, ironically enough. But it'll say like in the 1930s, this housed a center for racial hygiene or something, and it's really horrible stuff. But they mark it carefully. They try to, you know, pay attention to, we're not trying to deny this, but at the same time, we're using it because we think this building should be allowed to function. I'm trying to think of an example, like in the Korean case. I guess, no, another example, sure, because it's controversial. And then I have one more example. Teaching something like Kwanju in the Korean case.
Oh,
how
yeah.
do you respect the political divide, not saying which one, and say, we're going to pay attention to people who want to talk about the violence, but we're also going to recognize that there are going to be people who disagree with that. How do you try to find ways of allowing people to come to that conversation? One other quick example, the famous case of the U.S. when they tried to, in 1995, in the Smithsonian, display the Enola Gay, the plane that dropped the bomb.
Yeah.
That turned into, they basically had to shut it down and minimize it because they could not find a conversation. So the answer is sometimes you have to back away.
Even that would be controversial, huh?
Well, can I give you an example on that one?
Go ahead.
Paul Fussell, who I believe is now passed away, was a famous professor of English at UPenn. As someone who was 18 or 19 during 1944-45,
sure.
He wrote a piece called Thank God for the Atom Bomb, saying it saved me from going to fight a war in Japan in 46. That came out around the same time of the Smithsonian display. That threw oil onto the fire, and believe me, it got very controversial.
You know, speaking of which...
So yes, sometimes that's still enormously controversial.
When I was in college, one of my professors had a very special speaker, a person whose father saved the life of his father, was what it was. Well, that's how he opened this thing.
Okay.
And we had no idea who was coming
sure.
Right? And I was like, I don't know what's going on here. Whatever, you know, it's a keynote speech, and he's going to do a presentation. Turns out, the son of Robert Oppenheimer.
Oh, wow. Okay. I get it.
And I said, whoa, okay. So he starts off by saying, because thanks to his father, Robert Oppenheimer, that the atomic bomb was created and that was, you know, dropped on Hiroshima and also Nagasaki. And so it avoided further, I guess...
It avoided a major whole-scale invasion of Japan.
Yeah, and
hundreds of thousands.
And that's how he got to saying that, you know, his father had saved his father's life because, you know, who would have known? But that sparked a huge controversy with some of the students.
Precisely, and as you'll recognize, that there are major generational differences between people who might say, as more today, why wasn't there a demonstration? Mm-hmm. Why wasn't there some sort of process before the actual dropping that could have convinced the Japanese to not even go that.
But see, this is why we
discuss... In any case, it's much more of an open, yeah.
This is why we discuss, in many cases with Japan and a lot of their historical sites, like the Battleship Island.
Yep, which is another one up. Yeah.
A very, very controversial place.
That's another beautiful textbook case of difficult heritage, yeah.
But see, the thing is, they tried to hide that. One of the agreements that they had with the UNESCO was that they would put in the true historical facts on the Battleship Island, but they never did that for the tourists to find out.
I'm just going to say, but you do understand that to historians, even to use the word true is, it has to be a much longer conversation trying to recognize that there are multiple narratives there. I'm not going postmodern on you. I'm just saying that historians will want to not recognize the Japanese side at all, but recognize that you've got to get people at the table talking to each other about how to put together a narrative that everyone can be relatively comfortable with.
I really think it's up to each individual country to decide whether or not they're going to be demolishing the difficult heritage. Because, I mean, you talked about the German case, the Auschwitz, is still around. They haven't gotten rid of it.
But you understand if you're talking about the camps, a lot of those are in Eastern Europe.
Right. And so
Can I give you one quick one there? Are you aware, for example, that with some of the camps, they were used after 45 by Eastern European governments for their own purposes that we often don't talk about because we associate them. So they have multiple levels of difficult heritage.
Yeah, and so you kind of wonder why this left, but then there's a lot of people who visit the Auschwitz understand.
That's a perfect example of, that we, it's so horrible, but we need to remember precisely so
that doesn't happen again. And so maybe some people could have said the same thing about this, but it's a little bit different here. Let's talk about, because now in 1995 to 1996, the building is finally demolished. What was the decision? What was kind of the reason behind this? And how did this all
and
start?
The reasons that are officially cited are kind of interesting. So you have the first post-military, obviously 87 election, but you still have a military ruler in Notewu. But with King Il-sung coming in 93, you have some kind of a transformation and restoration of quote-unquote civilian rule kind of things. So that's part of it. The conversation is not right away and by no means unanimous that we should do this, but the official explanations they give are 50 years after 1945, so 45 to 95, this represents a nice timeliness. I believe there's some other connection going back a couple hundred years to Choson, but they cite these dates as this has been enough time, this is a good marking point, particularly the 50 years for 95. And with, again, this transformation to King Il-sung, as you said, the building is so controversial, perhaps it's time to move on, indicate that we're moving on. And it's not seen as an erasure so much as dismantling and a kind of maybe even like opening up that space again, for Koreans to think about it. And it's not immediately like one big destruction. It's a process between some point in 95 and 96 where they take off, I guess, the roof and then kind of piece by piece and then slowly disassemble it over a matter of months. But yeah, there was a conversation about that.
I wonder too, because we talked about the pros and cons of maybe leaving the so-called difficult heritage in place.
I personally, as a historian, I got here and I never got to see it. I got to see obviously the pieces. I wish, but I mean, I understand why and respect.
So there must have been some opposition to this.
Yeah. There were definitely people who probably thought more along these lines of exactly why don't we mark it in a certain way, or perhaps not continue to use it in this way, but still mark it as, again, as you said, this is something that we had experienced. We don't ever want to go through this again. Therefore, this is a kind of a useful way of. And again, there are still buildings in Seoul. Again, particularly the old city hall is the one that I always come to mind. I really like that.
You know, the one building all of a sudden that pops into my mind is I used to work at when I first started in broadcasting, I worked at a different radio station down by Namsan.
Okay. I know what you're going to get. This is that's a beautiful example.
And I think we talked about this too. And, you know, that building was a notorious building where, again, the South Korean government was, you know, taking people and accusing people of being commies and torturing people and trying to get answers out of them. And that was used as a radio station for years until, you know, they moved to Sangam where all the media, you know, it's located. And once that radio station moved out, they destroyed that building. They said, I mean, you know, don't want to be a part of dark history.
I was going to say, that's interesting. No, I mean, it's interesting the destruction is the same. Although I suspect that probably didn't get nearly the same fanfare because it was always kind of invisible to begin with.
Yeah, not a lot of people know about that place.
The other one, if we are okay on time.
We have about 30 seconds.
One or two more examples. One quick example. Some of the older American things from the immediate American period, like I don't think the Bondo Hotel is around anymore.
No.
But if you see pictures, that was for many of a long time the center of American power. In any case, another context of something that has kind of been erased quietly without opposition.
It's very interesting, this building. Again, I didn't have a chance to look at it myself, neither has Professor DeMoya, but we had a great discussion in this and how this also affects other maybe countries and their history. Professor DeMoya, thank you very much for your history lessons today. Have a great rest of your weekend. We'll see you again next week.
Thanks very much.
You can listen to Korea Now with me, SJ Lee, by downloading the Arirang Radio application or tune in online by visiting www.arirangradio.com. So make sure you tune in Mondays through Fridays, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Korea time.